flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Looking for a new home should be exciting, not frustrating. That's why Homes.com might just be the best home shopping site out there. Imagine searching for your dream home without ads cluttering your view. Homes.com's sleek, beautifully designed, ad-free interface makes your search simple and distraction-free. And if you're a parent, you know how important school information is. Homes.com gets it. They're the only site with detailed school and district info from multiple sources, including reviews from Niche. Plus, they've got a super comprehensive and transparent agent directory, making it easy to find the right expert to guide your journey. Oh, and here's a game changer. Homes.com always connects you directly with a listing agent who knows the home best. They even go beyond the basics, offering the most in-depth neighborhood content of any home shopping site, packed with details to help you find a community that feels like home. And the search tools? Unmatched. With 22 data visualization layers, 7 environmental layers, and filters for commute times and architectural styles, Homes.com truly is the home search you've been searching for. Go to Homes.com. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Welcome back, folks. So the Federal Reserve said that in the interest of fighting inflation, they will not cut rates in the near future. And joining us to talk to us about it is Ryan Young, Competitive Enterprise Institute senior economist. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Newell.
So, Ryan, talk to us about why this is or is not a good move by the Federal Reserve.
On balance, I think it is a good move, and the main reason is inflation. It's not conquered yet. We're not going back to that 9% inflation we had during the pandemic. That would take another COVID-scale disaster, another COVID-scale stimulus spending binge. That's not happening. At the same time, we can't get back down to 2%. It's just not happening. And the reason for that is that neither the Federal Reserve nor either party has any credibility with spending restraints. And to get inflation down to earth, it's going to have to take taming down deficit spending and some spending cuts. And unless that happens, people aren't really going to buy what the Fed is selling. So they can't cut rates, even though they'd like to. So holding steady, I think, is the right move at this point in time.
But what has changed? Because at some point we were able to achieve that 2%. The mindset in Congress hasn't changed, right? I mean, the spending has been on an increase. How many years now?
Oh, goodness. Second, last time we had a balanced budget was in the Clinton administration.
Yeah. So, I mean, so why was it okay to have the rate cuts before and not now?
Well, the reason is that the Fed has two missions, and those two missions contradict each other. The core mission is to keep inflation under control. So that requires a monetary policy that's a balancing act. On one side, you have all the dollars that exist. That's about $6 trillion right now. On the other side, you've got all the real goods and services that people produce, radio shows and cars and houses. And what the Fed is supposed to do is to keep those in balance. Suppose that real economy grows 10%, then the Fed grows the money supply at 10%. That's how prices stay stable. What happened during COVID is they got out of whack, and the Fed is still trying to get them back into whack, if that's even a phrase.
We seem to have a recent obsession of gauging inflation relative to egg prices. I mean, I've never seen so many questions asked by the media about the price of eggs. What's up with that?
Yeah, that's not inflation, thankfully. That's bird flu. It's decimating the chicken stock, and Yeah, there's a supply crunch. The prices are going to go up. That's not inflation. That's just supply and demand.
And, you know, when folks talk about it in that context, it's almost as though they're the Antichrist. That it's, you know, it's not inflation. How did we get to this point with this obsession about the price of an egg?
Well, people really, really hate inflation. It was the case in the 1960s and 70s. That's why there was so much political turmoil back then. It's why there was a lot of uncertainty during COVID. I think that's what got President Trump reelected. And if he's not a good steward of inflation, then the Republicans are going to be on the outs in the next election. So they should keep their eye on the prize, make sure that inflation stays under control, restrain their spending, give the Fed a free hand to do what it thinks right to keep interest rates where they need to be to restrain inflation. And hopefully we'll finally get back down to 2%, which is where we want to be.
Now, one of the criticisms of President Donald Trump, and I think you even mentioned it in your article, you know, about kind of his impulsivity as it relates to a number of policies. He's very impatient as well. How is that going to bode for the Federal Reserve?
Well, what it's creating is uncertainty. President Trump has already been pushing the Fed to lower interest rates. Lower interest rates means stimulus in shorthand, and he wants that. The Federal Reserve is independent, and it's guarding its independence. So Chairman Powell is saying no comment, and he's not going to comment on anything the president says about his job performance or about interest rates. At the same time, President Trump is pursuing some pretty radical policy changes. Some of them are great. Some of them aren't. What he's threatened to do with tariffs might actually raise inflation indicators a little bit, which means that the Fed would have to be more aggressive with rate cutting. On the other hand, President Trump might be cutting spending by quite a bit. Again, we'll see what happens. We don't know the plans yet, but if he does, that'll make the inflation problem a lot better, and the Fed can lay off a little bit. But you know, you have those two opposing forces, which one's going to be stronger? And especially at this early point when we don't know what his plans are for either one and they could change on a dime, we don't know. So that's another reason the Fed is standing pat. There's a lot of uncertainty right now.
We're visiting with Ryan Young, Competitive Enterprise Institute senior economist. Ryan, there's a lot of talk about tariffs, and I'm kind of curious. Trump's first administration, there was an imposition of a number of tariffs. I came to the understanding that Biden actually increased the number of tariffs that were implemented. Have we ever quantified, you know, what those tariffs meant to inflation during those 2 4-year terms?
We have a rough idea. The effect is small, but they do increase inflation indicators. They're not strictly inflation by an economist's hoity-toity definition because they don't change the number of dollars that exist. But they do make goods more expensive. They slow down how fast money circulates. People get less for their money. So they do raise prices, whether it's cars, houses, clothing, food, tariffs. They're a tax that raises prices, and the effect is big enough to show up in the consumer price index. But even if Trump radically raises tariffs, it wouldn't add much more than, say, half a percentage point to inflation. So it's there, but it's not the biggest effect in the world.
Ah, can't you see it? A sparkling roadside EV quick charge power facility. It's chargers, control panels, and switchgear powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean. We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We're now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Marketers, are you ready to make an impact with audio advertising? People are hungry for authentic connections in a world buzzing all around us. How do you cut through the noise and truly reach your audience? Visit stateofaudio.com to see Odyssey's State of Audio, the Trends Report. Uncover the secrets to high-impact creative. Learn how AI is revolutionizing the industry. And get ahead of the curve on measurement and audience trends. Don't just stay in the game. Win it. Visit stateofaudio.com and download your free copy.
Let's go back to eggs for a second. Obviously, the price of eggs has gone up, and what we are recognizing now, as you pointed out, it's not as a result of inflation. It's the supply and demand as a result of, I think, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of chickens they ended up killing because of the avian bird flu or whatever it may be. At a granular level, do we know how many of similar happenstances are out there in our economy that are actually contributing to inflation, and do we quantify that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, because you have that underlying monetary inflation we were talking about, but at the same time that all that is going on, you have all the supply and demand changes. When Putin invaded Ukraine, that made the prices of grain and oil go up. That wasn't inflation. It's because there was a supply crunch. When supply chains get snarled, say there's a dock worker strike or something like that going on, prices for goods that are suddenly facing shortages, that's not inflation. That's a supply crunch. That's supply and demand. So that's one reason why inflation gets a little complicated. Ideas are actually pretty simple, but so many things are going on at the same time, it can be hard to tease out what price change is coming from what reason.
And that supply chain, that distress on a supply chain, is that kind of the motivation of what's going on with this conversation about the Panama Canal? Because, you know, we've gone through these periods of time where we've had ships just stacked up on both sides waiting to get through.
That is part of the equation. The other is President Trump rightly wants to counter China's influence. I'm not sure I agree with him that taking back the Panama Canal is the best way to do that, but that's where he's coming from. I think he's got the right idea in mind. As far as larger supply chains, I think the main problem, frankly, is our ports are unionized and they're resisting automation to the point where our ports, as far as how many goods can get through, they're some of the worst in the developed world. That's one place where Europe is actually ahead of us, and I think that's shameful.
How far behind are we?
Our ports can, I think they're about a third to a quarter as efficient as the world's very best, like the ones in the Netherlands and some of the ones in Japan and China. They're using the latest technology. Just a small group of workers can move millions and millions of dollars worth of goods in hours. And here in America, we just can't do that. And here we have some of the smartest, most talented, hardworking people in the world, some of the best technology in the world, and we're making an intentional choice not to use all that. And I think that's causing a lot of problems, that, and it's big enough to show up in inflation indicators even.
So what do we believe that they contribute to inflation? I mean, this is an interesting conversation when you get down to this granular level, right? And you begin to dissect all of the contributors out there, and some of it is, as you just pointed out, our own choice.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. That's why I like studying it so much. it makes me appreciate just how hard the Federal Reserve's job is to do. I mean, on paper, the job's pretty simple. Keep the money supply in sync with whatever the real economy is doing. But there's so much else going on with these supply and demand problems, port strikes, bird flu with eggs, all these other things happening at the same time. How do you adjust to that? There's not always a right answer. So with the Fed's decision to stand pat, you can argue against it, but on balance, I think they're doing the right thing.
How much of this posturing, you never know what lurking in the mind of Donald Trump, and a lot of what he says is almost like a shock and awe to try and get folks to pause and think and maybe even potentially react and reveal where they are on certain issues. And it seems to me that one of the critical errors that we can make, in no matter who we are or what we're doing, is to respond in real time to what he is saying. And I'm not talking about what he does, but what he says.
Yeah, and to bring that back to tariffs, so far he's made threats against Mexico and Canada, against China, Colombia, I believe Denmark as well. Some of those he'll follow through on, and some of those he won't. Some of those aren't even related to international trade. But that kind of uncertainty for companies that are making long-term investments in different supply chains and suppliers, as far as buying and selling goods at the consumer level, that's really throwing a wrench into things. And while I can see where President Trump is going from strategically, it's also creating a great deal of uncertainty, and that is a cost that maybe he should figure into his calculations a little bit more.
But when you think about long term, how, you know, as an economist, how do you go about recapturing what America once was as the manufacturing giant of the world? And, you know, how do we go back in time? I mean, you know, what economic policy do you put in place, or sanction, tariff, whatever you want to, enormous, however you want to address it, to get back to that? I mean, we hear about this all the time, and I'm always curious, how do we get there?
That's a really good question, and I was looking at some manufacturing data. When did America make the most stuff in its entire history? And there's data on this. I was looking at it, and it wasn't in the 1950s when, you know, the big three auto companies had the whole industry to themselves. It wasn't in the 1970s when manufacturing employment peaked and unionization was still very high. The year that all-time manufacturing output peaked was in 2018. What put a dent in it a little bit was some tariffs and then COVID. And since it's been recovering and it's almost back to that near all-time record right now, it's 1% or 2% shy of that. So the patient is actually a lot healthier than people think.
Then why? I mean, I get the political reason for it. I mean, but what's interesting is you don't hear many people talk about that.
No,
I mean, this is the first time hearing, you know, what you just put forward. I mean, I find it very interesting.
Yeah, well, one is that nostalgia is a very potent political tool. If you're trying to court voters.
Yeah, I love that.
you can win a lot of elections by saying things are worse than they used to be. And guess who can make things better? Vote for me.
You can't paint in poetry, baby. But that's incredibly, I mean, I'm telling you, I'm in shock right now, and I have texts coming across where, Newell, we will never be the same as the 50s, and that was right before you made your comment. It's like, because there's this belief that those were the glory days, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we're doing a lot of other things in the service economy. I looked up as a proportion how much is manufacturing. So GDP is the entire economy, everything that's made and sold in America, that's what GDP is. In the 1950s, manufacturing was about 12% of GDP, about an eighth of the economy. Today, it's also about 12%. It's about the same as it was as a proportion of the whole economy, and that's with all the growth of computers and services and the decline of a lot of factory towns. We're still cranking out so much stuff that we are the second largest manufacturer on Earth. And the only reason that China has more manufacturing output, it's because they have four times our population. You would expect that.
Yeah. Is there a difference at a granular level of critical sectors of the economy that maybe back in the day it was a greater percentage of GDP than it is today?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. One area of concern that I'm concerned about is rare earth minerals. Those are used in a lot of computer chips and smartphones. China, so far, has a pretty sizable command of the known reserves. But the nice thing is that's starting to change because the way the Earth's crust is, those minerals tend not to be concentrated in one place or another, especially. So they're everywhere. It's a matter of access. And if we loosen up some permit regulations and allow people to exploit reserves and find new reserves, we've already found some here in the U.S., that could turn out to be substantial. So if we loosen our regulatory touch a little bit and allow people to exploit those resources, that'll be a nice blow to China and a nice boost for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan Young, Competitive Enterprise Institute senior economist, we truly appreciate your time and your insight. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Newell. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us, folks.